Well, James, you've written another book about the wildlife of Britain, and this is interesting because this is very much a sort of things to do over the summer guide, a travel guide, I suppose, as well, isn't it?
It is exactly that. It's a celebration of British nature, the rare creatures, the evocative creatures, the iconic creatures, with a suggested day out for each of 100 days between mid-May and late August across England, Scotland and Wales.
It would be a really interesting exercise, wouldn't it, using it as a reference tool in 15, 20 years' time to see what changes there have been, because you've been so precise in saying the range of dates when you see certain wildlife phenomena.
Absolutely. And I think also there may well be species that are harder to see in Britain in 15 to 20 years' time. So one classic example as a result of climate change would be a bird called the dotterel, which is like a little plover that lives on the mountaintops in Scotland. And all predictions say that within 50 years, that won't be breeding in Britain anymore. That will have gone. So this is almost a last chance to see book as well.
For about a generation, perhaps a bit more, wildlife was sort of out of the limelight, wasn't it? I mean, I grew up with the Observer Book of Birds, a little pocket book, and more recently there's been a big resurgence in countryside issues on TV, Springwatch, Countryfile. Organisations like the RSPB have got well over 1 million members now. Do you feel there is a huge amount of interest now in wildlife and the countryside, a kind of reconnection?
Well, there certainly seems to be a sense that, oh my God, everything is disappearing. If we don't do something now, it'll be too late. And people are rediscovering wildlife as a result of that. I think another example would be the amount of wildlife or nature writing that is now out there. 10 years ago, you'd be hard-pressed to find any book which was a narrative about nature. In the last 5 years, in particular, thanks to Robert McFarlane, a celebrated landscape writer, nature writer, there's just a plethora of material to read, and it's all very exciting. And I think the more momentum that builds and the associated media that comes with it, you know, Spring Watch, for example, Autumn Watch, now Winter Watch, the greater the love that Britons will display for their wildlife, the greater the chance we have of saving it.
With your big experience in wildlife reporting and wildlife watching, I guess a lot of this book requires you to very rigidly edit what goes in it because there's so much you could write about. So how did you sift what was included in the various chapters?
That's a really good question. I mean, there was so much to write about. I reckon I could have written 3 books about British summer wildlife. So I had a long list of possibilities and then kind of weighed them up against principles such as demonstrating the breadth of British wildlife experiences. I didn't want to just talk about birds. I wanted to talk about basking sharks and bumblebees as well. And then there's geographical spread. It's pointless having 100 days out that are all in around London, for example. Much of my readership may be there, but much of my readership is not there. So geographical spread, ensuring there are days from the Isles of Scilly right up to Shetland, was key. And then finally, a final factor, which is a new one for me and prompted by the change in my own personal circumstances, is the likely interest for families. So I use my 5-year-old daughter as a barometer for the excitingness or otherwise of each of the possibilities to decide which to include.
That's a really interesting way of doing it, isn't it? Because anybody who's got young kids will know that the attention span can be perhaps slightly altered compared to the surroundings, depending how cool things are in their perception. But also, there can be a difference between you as an adult and what engages you and what the kids like.
Absolutely. I suspect that modern technology, tablets and the like, has decreased that attention span even more so. But I know that from my daughter, once she does get into something, she doesn't leave it alone. So only last week, for example, we were out looking for adders. It was part of a search for the Easter Bunny. So we're not quite sure we saw the Easter Bunny, but we looked for adders and she loved that. And then we found a slow worm and she was confident enough to kind of pick up the slow worm, which is a type of lizard without legs, and was so enthralled with that, she turned to me and said, "Daddy, can we do this tomorrow as well?" So I think once you get that kind of buzz from a kid, it tells you that this is an experience worth capturing, it's an experience worth communicating, and it's an experience worth doing.
So is that a kind of a yardstick of success with this book? If you get say, a child going out with a family and you've gone for a specific weekend break somewhere to look for something, if they want to engage with wildlife after having taken part in a session guided by the book, is that what you're looking for? That's the sort of feedback you want?
That would be absolutely wonderful. That would make the book worth writing. If a child and a family are so excited by doing one day that they want to do another, and then that they want to join up with one of the many wildlife charities we have across Britain, and then stay interested in wildlife into the next generation when they're the adults, when they're the decision makers, when they're the voters, that would just be splendid.
I'm really interested in the way that you have, to use one of the terms in the book, make it a weekend, the way in which you've put together different ideas so people can plan a weekend away somewhere to get the best in wildlife. How did you go around approach that?
Well, it was a case of thinking through what else would be in the surrounding area. So many of the trips are going to be within, you know, an easy day trip from your house, that's fine. But if you live in Yorkshire, you don't really want to go down to Dorset for a day. You might want to spend a weekend there. So let's put myself in the position of being there, doing that day, and then what else would I want to see as well? What else could I see? Is there a nearby nature reserve that is worth visiting for a different type of creature? Or can I call in on something on the way back home? That type of thing.
I was trying to score different parts of the country to see which area had it all. And just from looking at some of the places you featured, Dorset does pretty well, doesn't it? With red squirrels, basking sharks, bog bush crickets. Do you think Dorset is one of the key places to go and see wildlife over the summer?
Absolutely. That's certainly the case. Dorset and East Anglia are two of the best wildlife watching areas in Britain. There's no doubt about that. But that doesn't mean that there's not plenty of places everywhere else as well. So I don't think we need to consider that particular counties to be a honey trap for wildlife. I wouldn't want, you know, every single reader of the book to go to a single county. Part of the idea is to show the diversity of what Britain has and the depth and the breadth of the wildlife wonders that we've got.
You have featured as well the Farne Islands, and the way you describe them, it seems like they're a kind of a nature nirvana.
Absolutely. I mean, I'd say they're Britain's answer to the Galapagos. Certainly the sensations when you're there of wildlife in absolute intensity all around you, huge numbers of terns flying around you and indeed flying at you, puffins and other auks, kittiwakes, beautiful gulls everywhere. So there really is sort of so much wildlife literally within touching distance that it's just an assault on the senses. And by senses, I mean not just sight and sound, I mean smell as well, because the seabird colony can be rather pongy.
Well, let's look at some places to go. If I'm perhaps deciding what the family does for a weekend in August, we've got the car ready to go. We can go anywhere, stay for a weekend somewhere. What would your top tip be out of all the places you featured in the book?
Ooh, that's a really, really tough call. I wonder about going to Southwest Wales, to Pembrokeshire and Ceredigion. And there you might go to the beach at Borth in Ceredigion and see a spectacle the like of which is unparalleled in Britain. And that's on a rising tide in the early morning, tens of thousands of Manx shearwaters, which are pretty much our equivalent of the albatross, a bit smaller granted, but our equivalent of the albatross, gathering to feed on shoals of fish that have been brought up towards the shore. So that would be a fantastic start to the day. And then the newest, most famous resident of Wales, at least with feathers, is the pair of ospreys, the breeder and new nature reserve very close by. And I think a day spent at that reserve, wandering around there, seeing the progress of the young osprey chicks, watching the chicks, you know, possibly fly for the first time, would be a wonderful way to end the weekend.
And for people that love flowers, in terms of flora, what would be the national treasure? Where should people go to see what you would recommend seeing?
bluebells tend to top the list of Britain's favourite flower every time such a census is carried out. And Britain's best bluebell wood, arguably, is in Northamptonshire. It's a place called Shortwood. And to see sort of a lilac wash below a kind of green woodland is a sight that's commonplace, but at the same time can rarely be beaten. So there's something about the collective, the assemblage in flowers that can really make them make everything the sum, more than the sum of its parts, put it that way.
Do you know what's really heartening? The fact that you've written this book and you are, we're making you work for this, you're having to think about recommendations. It's pleasing that there are so many potential choices.
Indeed. I think we cover just under 50 counties in the book, and there's probably 200 locations, roughly 400 different species that are featured in quite considerable detail. And they vary from, you know, tiny orchids that we've already talked about to huge basking sharks, again, that we've mentioned. But there are other things as well. I mean, stuff that's perhaps not quite on the radar as being amazing, but really is. So one of my particular favourites is a little creature, a little insect called the dune tiger beetle. It's only about a centimetre and a half long, but it fairly sprints across beaches in Norfolk and also in North Devon and South Wales. And is striped, as you'd imagine from a creature called a tiger beetle, striped black and, in this case, cream, and is a real ferocious predator. And getting down and on your hands and knees and getting intimate with such a wonderful natural being is a real treat.
How much of a challenge was it to write the book, bearing in mind there are some people who'll buy it who have an extensive knowledge of wildlife and other people who will know very little?
There's something for everybody. It's fair to say that the people who review the book in magazines and the like tend to be the expert.
Where would you go if you could go anywhere over the next couple of weeks for your own personal enjoyment? What would you go and look at and see?
I think I would head up as soon as it gets to May, late May. I would head up to Cumbria and go and visit a limestone pavement called Gate Barrows. Limestone pavements are wonderful in themselves. It's like going on a geography field trip from school with all the clints and the grikes and wonderful scenery. And up there, there's been a special conservation program to reintroduce an orchid that was almost extinct within Britain, an orchid called the Lady's Slipper Orchid. And it's an amazing bloom that combines a wonderful red, almost Cinderella-like slipper with long yellow petals. It looks quite tropical, but it also looks quite comical. And going up to Gate Barrows in late May, early June, and seeing this amazing flower would not just be a spectacle in itself, but also be a sort of pilgrimage to the conservationists who are trying to turn around the fortunes of wildlife in our country.
And you make it so easy with map references as well.
Well, absolutely. I mean, this is a travel guide. There's no point in just saying, go and have a look in Yorkshire for a particular flower. You've got to help people get to the right site and get there with ease. Otherwise, they'll just be disappointed. So absolutely, there's nice writing in here. That's the inspiration part. But there's also the information that you need to go and make the trip, the weekend, a success.
The book is called A Summer of British Wildlife. Finally, James, how do you define summer? When does it start and end?
Well, that was one of the most trickiest things.
I'll bet.
So, you know, quite often a British summer starts in September and ends the same day in September. So I had to be a little bit fluid with the term. So I've defined it as mid-May until late August, which is 100 calendar days. And I've done that in part so you get a little bit of spring in there, but also quite a lot of the school summer holidays. And if you remember that the child friendliness of each day is quite key to the book, then getting in the summer holidays was a must.
The book is available in all good retailers. You can get it on Amazon as well.
You can get it wherever you would find a book for sale. It'll be there. And indeed, Amazon sold out within the first week, and I'm taking that as a good sign.
Wow, that's excellent. James Lowen, thank you.
Thank you, Gary.